The lesson is taken from Esther, chapter 3, verses 1 to 14. This can be found on page 503 of the Pew Bibles, or the Bibles being handed out now. Esther, chapter 3, verse 1. Haman's plot to destroy the Jews. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet, having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the pur, that is, the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury." So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please." Then, on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Well, good morning. Right, today, our story. Last week, we started to think about the story of Esther And we began back at the point at which Esther is made queen. I'm just going to do a very, very brief recap. Xerxes is the king of a vast, vast kingdom. And he's a show-off. He's not very wise. He's a bit of an egomaniac. He has a queen, Vashti. And when he throws a party for all the important people in his kingdom and invites all the men to come and join him, the queen does the same with all their wives and other halves and women. And she has a party and a great feast. King Xerxes decides he wants to show off how beautiful his wife is, calls her, tells her to come to the feast, rather implies that she might come just wearing her crown and not a lot else. She objects to this and refuses to come. Xerxes gets mad, takes advice, is told by the people who bring him bad advice that what he should do is issue an edict that every wife needs to obey her husband, that the men are to be the rulers of their households, rather missing the point that he has just demonstrated extremely publicly that he's not the king of his own household, even though he may be the king of this vast kingdom. The advisors say, you need to get rid of Vashti, she's not great. And so they say, why don't you look for a new queen? Why don't you have a huge harem of virgins, pretty young virgins, gather them from around the country, then night by night, take your pick. They'll come to you one at a time, and when you find one that you fancy, then make her your queen, based purely on her beauty and her ability in bed. That may not be the wisest way to choose your queen. Anyway, he does this. It's people trafficking. It's taking girls who don't want to be there in to act as sex workers for him. It's really not great. His officials go out and find these girls. Now, Esther is a Jewish girl. She's been brought up by her cousin when her parents die, and they are in exile. And her cousin, Mordecai, decides that it would be good for her to have some security. And he decides that the way that's going to happen is by encouraging her to go in and to become part of this harem, because they'll be looked after, they'll be cared for, regardless of whatever else they might need to do. So she goes, and she is obedient and beautiful and fits in and becomes Xerxes' queen. He decides that she is the best. And by this means, God puts her into a position of incredible influence, which isn't apparent at the time, but will become so. And at the end of our chapter, Mordecai, who has stayed as a gatekeeper or a porter, hears about a plot from a couple of people who want to kill the king. And he tells Esther, and Esther tells Xerxes, and Mordecai's name goes down in the annals of the king. It's recorded that he's a good bloke who's helped out. And that's kind of the end of it for the moment. So we are now at the point 4 years later where Haman turns up. One of the other important things about Esther is that in the whole book, it doesn't actually mention God, nor does it mention worship. Because God is assumed to be there. It's an important book for Jewish people. It's the story that gives the background to Purim, which is one of their festivals, a very joyous festival, when they remember the events that happened throughout this book. If you haven't read the whole book yet, I suggest you do. It is a cracking story, and it kind of makes more sense when you know the whole picture. I haven't got time to tell you everything this morning. We'll get to it in weeks to come. So, 4 years on, our chapter starts with this elevation of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. It's unmerited reward. We don't know what Haman has done. We're not told what Haman has done, that Xerxes decides he should be given this great honor. But it follows on from that last bit of the last chapter where we see unrewarded merit, that Mordecai has done the right thing but hasn't been rewarded for it. So there's this kind of counterbalance here. Our title is The Cost of Conscience. And I looked up conscience online, as I do. I do have a dictionary somewhere, but Google's quicker. Conscience is an aptitude, faculty, intuition, or judgment that assists in distinguishing right from wrong. Helps us to distinguish right from wrong. That's what this is all about. We've seen a lot of wrong in the chapters before this. So Xerxes, this king, he would have been regarded not just as a king, but as somebody with divine power, a god to be worshipped. And he confers part of this power and this right to worship on Haman. The reverence that he says everyone has to pay Haman is not just a sign of respect, but an act of worship. Mordecai, when he hears this, does not want to bow down and worship Haman. He could have kept himself hidden. He's one man in a crowd, and he could have protected himself, but he chooses not to. Now, you might assume that this is because he's a good Jew, and it's his faith that's stopping him, that he's obeying the commandment to bow to nobody but God. There is another possible explanation that goes alongside this, which is that when we're told who Haman is, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, it identifies him as a person from the Amalekite race. Now, the Amalekites were the people who Joshua went out to fight near the end of Moses' life. And Joshua went and fought the Amalekites. And do you remember that story where Moses holds his hands up? Because God says, as long as you're holding your hands up over the battle, you will win over the Amalekites. And Joshua does that. And Aaron and Hur go up and hold Moses' arms up because he's getting tired. To say, when I first started doing communion and you do this bit, the first couple of months, you'd sort of get to the end of a Sunday morning and think, oh, I didn't know I had those muscles. But anyway, imagine holding your hands up in prayer. So they do that. When Moses' hands grew tired, it tells us at the end of Exodus 17, they took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on each side, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. This is the important bit. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of